The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead.
David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. Just listening to the state Supreme Court make that ruling on the campaign financing. And I just got to say, you know, when they say, well, they don't dictate who gets it. What if you didn't like anybody? That means your tax dollars are still going to support a bunch of politicians that you don't like. I mean, just picture Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, and Shama Sawant all on the city council ballot, and how many people would not want to vote for any of them, or certainly not give money to any of them, and yet they'd all receive money. Sorry, it's not the big lead. It's just something I had to say right off the bat, because I thought if I lived in the city of Seattle, I'd be irate that with all the problems they have and all the potholes that need fixed and the services that they claim are underfunded, that they find it necessary to have a public financing of candidates. Very annoying. But let's get to the big lead.
The big lead, top national.
As you may or may not have heard, the ICE raids are coming this Sunday. Not the ICE capades, the ICE raids, as in Immigration and Customs Enforcement. CBS's Omar Villafranca has the latest on the postponed raids.
ICE is reportedly targeting about 2,000 immigrants who are in the country illegally and have been ordered deported. The agency is also saying that they're traditionally focusing on those with a criminal history, but any immigrant who's violating U.S. law could be arrested.
They'll be starting fairly soon.
President Trump renewed his threat last Friday to order mass deportations of undocumented migrant families. The raids were postponed in June after the president previewed the operations on Twitter, stating ICE would remove millions of illegal aliens. The raids have been a flashpoint in immigrant communities across the country.
The so-called raids, it's interior enforcement. We do it every day.
CBS News spoke with Acting Customs and Border Protection Commissioner Mark Morgan about the agency's plans in an interview last month.
If you're a mother with a kid, is that mother going to be handcuffed? No, she doesn't need to be handcuffed. But if you're a criminal alien and you've been convicted of murder, sexual assault, and etc., are you going to be handcuffed? You bet you're going to be handcuffed.
The possible raids come amid increasing scrutiny over conditions at migrant detention centers. On Wednesday, reporters toured a new HHS facility for children in Carrizo Springs, Texas. Video shows clean rooms and children in classrooms, which contrasts troubling images from a recent DHS Inspector General's report that condemned unsanitary conditions and dangerous overcrowding at some CBP facilities.
Fue un dolor terrible poder ver a mi.
In an emotional hearing Wednesday, Yasmin Juarez said she blamed unsafe conditions and poor medical care at an ICE detention center in Dilley, Texas, for the death of her one-year-old daughter, Marie. Lawmakers were visibly shaken by her testimony. Some were brought to tears.
Corazón, me arrancaron el alma.
It's like they tore out a piece of my heart, she said, like they tore out my soul.
All right, so here's the sad thing. This kind of thing has been happening for a long time. There was a Frontline report that had details that are almost exactly like what you're hearing about right now, but these were back in the mid-Obama administration. I'll try and find the audio for it and share it with you. But the emphasis is now on the Trump administration. The United States, there was a column recently put about how the United States is bad at incarcerating people. Bad at incarcerating prisoners, bad at detaining those who want to cross the border illegally. We're just bad at it. And so they've got all kinds of extra challenges, of course, when there's large groups of people, people by the thousands coming across the border illegally, in some cases already suffering from illness and the tough environment that they escaped from and that they had to go through in order to get here. That makes it tough. But back to the ICE raids. They're all coming this Sunday. Everybody seems to know that they're coming this Sunday. President Trump's been talking about them on Twitter. You know, it's a strange thing. You never see this on a show where they're going to launch a raid, where they go on the radio and tell everybody, hey, going to have a raid coming up. It's going to be on Wednesday. And that's Wednesday about 3 o'clock. We'll be knocking on doors. And P.S., you don't actually have to let us in. Because we don't have the right to go in unless you say it's okay. So, you know, just don't answer the door on Wednesday at 3 p.m. if you put up with it. So it's a strange thing to me. Also, President Trump plans to talk about the citizenship question after his social media summit at 2 p.m. We're going to go live to hear the president talk about what sounds like it will be an executive order regarding a citizenship question on the census. So that's what it looked like he was going to do based on some of the information from the president. He is going to be in the midst of a social media summit, which there's a lot of people that are upset that about who was not invited to the summit. Others upset about who was invited to the summit. We'll have some additional details on that coming up a bit later in the show as well.
The Big Lead, top trending.
Amazon plans to spend $700 million to retrain a third of its U.S. workforce in new skills. CBS's David Begno spoke with Amazon's worldwide consumer CEO about how the training is going to work.
We traveled to Amazon's Seattle headquarters to talk with its worldwide consumer CEO, Jeff Wilke, about how these programs are going to work.
Would you compare this to going to, I don't know, university and 2 years of training?
It's kind of like grad school.
And the program's names feel collegiate, like Machine Learning University for on-site training and Amazon Technical Academy for software engineer roles.
As technology changes work, they have the opportunity to advance in their career and take advantage of those changes.
Right, but you sound like your PR people. Give me the realistic version, right? Like, what do you need your employees to start doing with this training?
Creating great jobs means that people can have a career that's more than just the job they enter. And we think we have the responsibility to help them to acquire the skills that are going to be necessary as the world changes.
When I look at the video of the robots, I think that seems like an efficient, quick way of doing something, which would eliminate the need for a person to do it.
Well, we've deployed about 200,000 robots. At the same time, we've added 300,000 people. So what's happened is we've added more things that require more human work and judgment in certain areas, but we can add robots to do some things that humans would just have to repeat over and over again.
It's basically like any other industry. The automation takes over the parts that the human beings, that it can from human beings, but human beings are going to be required for other parts, and it'll all depend on the productivity. What's fascinating about this is, you know, the reporter, CBS's Begno, seems to be getting at, well, this is really for Amazon's benefits, not just for the workers. Well, of course, it has to be mutually beneficial. But it is interesting that Amazon is willing to spend that kind of money, $7,000 per worker on average, to train them, to give them the opportunity to get into other jobs and other positions. So it's a significant investment. It gives people an opportunity to move up the ladder at Amazon, move into different areas that might be in higher demand. And also, as Amazon points out, some of those skills are transferable to other high-tech industry as well, so that if they took the training and they decided they didn't like being at Amazon, they would have better job prospects elsewhere. So, you know, it's going to be tough for those whose obsession it is to villainize Amazon to keep pointing in that direction. But as far as the robots go, Skynet all over again. You know, at some point, there is a part of you that thinks, gosh, you know, at what point does the human being become obsolete? But then you read about Amazon expanding, for example, into grocery delivery, which is particularly difficult for automation because of all the different sizes of the barcodes, the different temperature requirements, the different sizes of packaging with the foods and other things. So that's been somewhat difficult for Amazon. And who knows, when the robotics is able to take over one aspect of the company, it might mean the company will expand into some other kind of service that will, of course, require the same or more human beings in order to accomplish the task. You know, that's part of the fluctuation in skills that we've seen throughout the history of economies, and right here in the United States as well. I mean, just imagine, you know, people working with horses and wagon wheels and other things when the automobile started to take off. You know, huge changes, and you can't go backwards. And that's the way it works out.
The Big Lead, Big Local.
Mayor Jenny Durkan of Seattle has new legislation to protect tenants, new tenant protections that would give renters earlier notification on sales of properties and more time to find a new place. And she's not the only one. The legislation, sponsored by citywide council member Teresa Makeda, would modify a 2015 measure that required owners of multifamily rental housing with five or more housing units, at least one of which rents affordably, to provide written notice of the owner's intent to sell the property to the city's Office of Housing and the Seattle Housing Authority at least 60 days prior to being listed or advertised, so at least 2 months. The change looked to give those two bodies time to examine the property, buying the property, to keep its rental units affordable. They wanted nonprofits and government agencies to look into buying properties before they were sold. The council member said in Seattle's current real estate market, tenants and affordable housing providers often struggle to compete. Many buyers come with cash in hand and buy up properties within days of being listed. And buildings are often sold without ever being listed at all, leaving fewer opportunities for lower-income buyers to get a foot in the door. The problem I have with that statement is, what would that tell you? If you're selling a property and people are knocking at your door before the listing's even out yet, right? What would you do? I know what I'd do. I'd say, I'm going to be taking bids for the next 10 days or so or 2 weeks. And I've seen this in countless houses where they want offers to come in so that they can weigh them. You know, when I bought my first house, it was an extremely hot market in Edmonds. And I remember they were accepting offers in. And so I put in an offer that was a couple thousand above the asking price. And I did it because I assumed other people would get to the asking price, and I wanted to make my offer look the best. But they were delaying because they expected people to, to go above the asking price. And they did. They were right. So, you know, if somebody's coming in so fast, you realize automatically you've sold it for too little. It's like, you know, if you put a dresser or something up on Craigslist or something and you've got 40 offers, you know, within the first 15 minutes, you know you put the price on too low and you could have sold it in some other way. And they say, quote, we need every tool to help level the playing field for tenants and nonprofit organizations in Seattle to secure ownership of their buildings when they come up for sale, preserve affordability, and create more first-time home ownership options to exercise greater self-determination in their housing. You know, that's just not going to work. Right? You're not going to get a level playing field. If someone is low income, they're never going to be on a level playing field with people who are high income in property areas where the property is worth a fortune. You know, or you can pick and choose winners and losers, and you'll end up helping a very select group of people in order to get political allegiance at the expense of much larger groups of people. So, you know, better to me to figure out what regulations or what kinds of things would allow for additional density without ruining neighborhoods. What kinds of regulations do we have in Seattle that are increasing the housing costs that might be unnecessary? In this case, we have evidence that despite this current law being in effect for the last, couple of years, not a single government agency or a nonprofit has purchased any of the properties where the notification was there. So, you know, you're putting people through a hoop that doesn't really matter. And now they're going to put them through two hoops instead so that they can virtue signal and say, I care about affordable housing, but it's not necessarily going to do anything to make housing actually affordable. But it does let people know that they, quote unquote, care. And that's part of the problems with this kind of thing. Owners would have to sign a declaration. One piece of legislation proposed, owners would sign a declaration submitted to the Office of Housing at the same time as a written notice saying that they've complied with the requirements. The penalty for failing to comply with the requirements of notification would be increased from $2,000 from $500. You know, and again, we've already shown that it's not working. Now they want to make it bigger and more complicated, and I'm not sure that that's going to make anybody better off at all anyway. So, you know, again, more regulations, more expense, more drama. The harder it is you make it for people to sell, the less likely I think it is that they're going to be wanting to get into the affordable housing business anyway because it scares people off. They're going to be thinking, gosh, it's going to take me 3 months to get out of this. What if something happens in my other business or my other investments and I want to get out? Maybe they'll change the rules on me again, and that can be an issue.
The Big Lead, top trending.
The news on juice just keeps getting worse and worse. Pretty soon, you're going to see City of Seattle ban things like Sunny D or any other juices that are out there. Reports a few months ago that fruit juice was worse for you than soda.
George Sr., you need more juice. Where's the juice? Give my son the juice!
Now, a new study has found that a small glass of juice or soda a day is linked to an increased risk of cancer. But before you say, wait a second, Dory Monson's gone. He drinks a ton of Diet Coke. Rest assured, this link found no link whatsoever between diet soda and cancer, just sugary juices, including all natural juices, and pop and cancer. So we're out of it. But the juice, big trouble. CNN reporting a small glass of juice or soda a day linked to cancer. It was just a small glass, by the way. About a third of a typical can of soda, according to the study, was linked to an 18% increase in overall cancer risk and a 22% increase in risk for breast cancer. The research looked at more than 100,000 French adults. And so the study indicates that it doesn't matter if you're drinking sugary pop or you think you're doing something healthier by drinking the sugary juice. The link is there either way, and it's just as strong. So I guess what we're going to have to do is stop marketing juice to young people, get rid of any cartoons, put them in the category of Joe Camel, get a bunch of TV commercials on there. Where's Bob Ferguson when you need him? Attorney General Ferguson can start suing the juice companies now for marketing to young people. You just walk through a juice aisle, and there's all kinds of, hey, the juice is good for you, you know, filled with vitamins, luring the children in. Watch out for the juice.
The Big Lead, Bizarro World.
Jeremiah Sullivan has been studying sharks for over 40 years, and he's been bitten thousands of times. And he also thinks he can get to understand any animal.
You know, for the most part, anybody that spends that much time in the water, you're a little bit trepidatious about sharks because what you've heard isn't necessarily good. And back in those days, there was no shark diving community. It was way ahead of all that curve. And as a young marine biologist, my interest was the human-shark interaction. I was a big believer that there is a possibility for friendly encounters, that all creatures can get along if you just take the time to understand and experience them, you know, respectfully and responsibly. I'm happy to have seen that that's worked out quite spectacularly with the development of the shark diving industry.
Out to prove that all creatures can get along, National Geographic's going to air a special called Man vs. Shark, featuring Sullivan being intentionally bitten intentionally. What's the proper phrasing of that? He's purposely going into the water with a tiger shark, a 14-foot tiger shark, to test his latest specially designed protective gear, a composite suit built to withstand the blow from an axe and, not coincidentally, the bite of a 14-foot tiger shark. And we know he survives because he's here promoting the National Geographic special, Man versus Shark. That certainly qualifies as bizarro. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. You want to text us? You want to comment? You want to rant? Text us on the Online Trading Academy text line, 98973. That's 98973. Dory Monson shows. Nicole Jennings joins us now with a great story of a Washington State Patrol officer who helped out a German family in need. They wanted to explore the great United States, but unexpected things happened. She did a great feature package on this story. Here it is.
In just a truck and attached RV, Benjamin and Melanie Fischer of Oldenburg, Germany, are hitting every one of the 49 continental U.S. states in 1 year with their four kids.
We are visiting as many historical sites as possible, a national park.
Having studied and worked in the U.S. previously, they wanted to give their temporarily homeschooled kids an up-close cultural education and to show them the kindness of everyday Americans in light of negative portrayals of the U.S. in international media.
Just to show the kids why we love this country so much.
Just so they see what it's like over here and that, you know, what they see on TV is not the truth and it's not really what it's like.
we love this country, and I think, yeah, could just see that in every state life.
Never was the spirit of American generosity more obvious than through the gesture of Washington State Patrol Sergeant Bradford Moon this past weekend. Just 2 miles from crossing into their 49th and final state, Oregon, the Fisher's trailer wheel got stuck and pulled the truck into a ditch, as 15-year-old Jakob described.
When we started falling, I just heard someone scream, and I saw us driving into this ditch. And the first thing I thought was just, when we were laying there, how am I going to get out? Because my door was not willing to open up. And my seatbelt wouldn't open because I was hanging on it, and under the pressure it wouldn't open.
The Fishers were luckily unharmed and managed to climb out of the truck's sunroof. But the truck and trailer were totaled, and many of their possessions were destroyed or had been thrown out of the damaged RV, as Sergeant Moon observed when he responded to the scene.
It appeared that the family had pretty much just lost about everything. I realized that I was looking at their only method of transportation in their home upside down in the ditch.
Unfortunately, on a holiday weekend in a rural area, rental car agencies were closed and motels were booked. Sergeant Moon's wife, Shauna, came to give rides and help collect the scattered belongings, but she and her husband wanted to help out even more. Motivated by their Christian faith, as well as by the positive attitude of the Fishers in spite of the catastrophe, they offered to host the German family at their Kathlamet home with their 4 sons for the next several days.
They're just very impressive with the faith and the demeanor they had, and it made it very easy for my wife and I to take that step, and, you know, it felt right to us. It felt like a good thing.
The Fisher and Moon kids have become fast friends during the stay. Both families have 4 children, and both even have sons named Eli. In fact, little Eli Fisher has attached himself to teenage Eli Moon, according to his parents. As we spoke on Tuesday, the kids were outside taking part in a scavenger hunt designed by Jakob.
Most of these kids are pretty much in the age range like our kids, and so they've been playing, and I think they've gotten to know each other really well, and I think that's helped our kids a lot to get over this whole experience very quickly.
It has been not just a chance to make friends, but also a cross-cultural exchange. The holiday weekend let the Fishers experience classic American activities in a regular household, like seeing post-July 4th fireworks and eating s'mores around the campfire. And in return, the Moons got to learn about Germany.
It's been fun to share our world with them and just to see different things. And they've shared a lot about their culture and what Germany's like. And it's good. It's good for my kids. We've never traveled anything other than just in the Western United States.
Now the youngest Moon, 9-year-old Josh, says that he wants to take German in high school so he can go stay with his friends in Oldenburg.
Just a terrific adventure of getting to know this family.
With a rented van, the Fishers are now heading out for the Oregon coast to complete the final leg of their journey. But they will never forget the kindness of Sergeant Moon, who exemplified why they went on the road trip in the first place, to experience the true heart and soul of America.
One of the most amazing parts of our journey is just meeting people, and when there's trouble, how many people are willing to help out. And same with the Moon family here. It's just, we've just been overwhelmed with their kindness. It's just been wonderful to get to know them, and I think we'll be lifelong friends.
I love this story in so many different ways. I love how the family comes here to try to teach their kids that the Americans are not like they're portrayed on television. And European television is pretty soundly anti-American. Culturally, you know, you're watching TV, we're always, you know, our villains tend to have German accents, you know, like it's
or
like,
Russian.
Or Russian.
To be fair.
Yeah, well, mostly German, but yeah, sometimes Russian.
Depending on when the movie was made.
Yeah. It's pretty powerfully anti, like, you know, the CIA is always at fault. The ugly American is a brute and a bully, and so it's a wonder that more people don't have a negative opinion of the United States, given the level of inculcation they get from their cultural media choices. But in this case, they come, they experience basically what Alexis de Tocqueville experienced way back in the day, which was, Americans don't wait for government intervention. They oftentimes they see a problem and they fix it themselves. And that's what this officer did as well. Meet with them personally, Nicole?
No, I wish I could have. They were, you know, way down in southwest Washington by kind of near Astoria, Oregon. So it would have been a really long trip for kind of trying to do this story quickly. But I did get to talk to them on Skype. And we actually got to speak a little bit of German together, which was really cool.
Um die Diplomarbeit da zu machen mit einer Firma, 3 Monate.
Okay.
Das aber
okay. Und jetzt wohnt ihr in Oldenburg, im
genau.
Norden.
Mm-hmm.
He said, we plan to go on vacation to Oregon, and you said, I like cheese and bread.
Yeah, that's exactly what we were talking about.
I too took German in high school. Yeah.
But it just, you know, a great way to bond with this family. And I could see how they became such good friends with Sergeant Moon's family so quickly. I mean, both families, I was able to speak to Sergeant Moon as well, and just wonderful people all around, you know, really easy to bond with them and very kind, very appreciative of everything. And
it's pretty impressive for a state patrol officer to say, you know what, no, it's not just, hey, I'm going to give you a ride and I'm going to bring you to, you know, this place that has shelter. It's I'm going to let you spend the night and I'm going to let you stay several days at my house over a holiday weekend.
Yeah,
you know, with all your belongings. I mean, that is it's a pretty big imposition. That's a really beautiful hospitality on his part when these folks are in need, and on the part of his wife as well.
Yeah, it's pretty unprecedented. I mean, obviously the Washington State Patrol does gestures of kindness for people every day, you know, buying them meals or giving them rides or whatever. But this is something that you know, Sergeant Moon's superiors said they never heard of anything like this. Here's when he's talking about he called his wife to ask her to help, and she right away knew they needed to make the ultimate gesture here.
I stepped away for a minute and called my wife and told her, I said, I know I've never called you with this before, but I said, I think we need to help these people. And my wife took a deep breath and said, okay. And so she unloaded our Suburban of all of our stuff and drove out.
And then he said, but if you want to, I mean, we don't have much space, but we'd be more than happy to either, you know, put you up in a home, or my mother and father-in-law, they live next door and they have a little gym attached to their house. You could also stay there. And at first I was like, well, they're already helping us out so much. I don't know if we can accept that.
Did he say a gym attached to their house?
So they were able to stay in this gym that's attached to Sergeant Moon's in-laws home. And they said it's been really great, actually, because not only do they have space to sleep and space for the six family members, but they're also able to lay out all of their possessions that they were able to collect from the scene of the accident and, you know, sort through what's damaged, what they can keep. So it's just given them a bit of relaxation, but also that space that they needed to go through all that, because they basically collected everything they had brought here and collected here for a year. They have, you know, in garbage bags now, everything that was salvaged.
Plus, they got a solid workout every morning, you know.
Yeah.
They've got the gym there.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, just not that many people have a gym attached to their house. It kind of stuck out at me.
Like, yeah, I thought that was cool.
Yeah, that is cool. It's one idea. I'm going to put that on my list of things to get, but... Yeah, that's the other thing is, you know, the feeling of imposition. You don't want to accept that kind of help, but they take it anyway. That's great stuff. All right, we got time for one more cut. What's your favorite of those that didn't make it in?
Ooh, let's see. Let's do this one.
My kids, my three youngest especially, have just been really, their ages match up really well, and so they've been hanging out. They all just left a minute ago to go on a scavenger hunt that the Fisher's oldest boy hit a bunch of clues all over our property and some neighboring properties, and they're out doing stuff together. They've been playing games and keeping each other entertained while Ben and Melanie have been making plans and going through and sorting through what they're going to take with them and not.
I think it's so cool how they've all been able to bond, you know, across the language barrier, across the cultural barrier, playing the way that kids have since the beginning of time. And I think it's beautiful.
They will never forget it.
Yeah.
So, Alf Peterzane, Nicole Jennings, you can hear more on MyNorthwest.com. And thank you to the Washington State Patrol. Always there in a pinch. David Bowes in for Jory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. Thank God it's Thursday. Boy, we're just going straight into the weekend. But wait, no. We've got to work tomorrow, too. But with this story in the Washington Post, there's a Belgian nonprofit named FEMA that decided to start giving their employees new free time. And they started a four-day work week. And it's catching on in some places where employers are experimenting with four-day work weeks. A one-year experiment starting in January, FEMA implemented a 30-hour work week for its approximately 60-person staff, which means basically they're mostly taking Fridays off. Now, they're being followed through December by Free University of Brussels researchers who are studying the impact of the additional leisure time on women and their children. rather sexist way to study, wouldn't you think? You know, I mean, what about dudes and their kids? What about dads? Come on. Anyway, P.S., by the way, guys die younger, right? Maybe we could use a little less stress time, okay? Let's get us a four-day work week. Anyway, so they're following this, and the colleagues so far, what do they think about the four-day work week? This is going to be shocking. They love it. They prefer that. So
I think in the future it's going to look so barbaric that we had to work 5 day weeks. It's just like, you know, people working 70 or 80 hours a week in industrial times. I just think people are going to look back and like, wow, you guys worked 5 days a week.
You think that'll be the case?
Yeah.
They'll be looking back going, you know, forget about the Holocaust, the Khmer Rouge. You know, these people had to work a 40-hour work week, you know.
It's too much. You can't do anything.
I don't think it's going to end up as one of those retroactive, this is just the horrible time to live thing.
Would you prefer a four-day work week?
Oh, yeah. I used to work 4/10s many times in construction and stuff. When you had a choice, you could work, you know, or even in government, there's often options where during certain months you can choose, you know, what kind of schedule you want. I like that because it cuts down on the commute. You know, you're not driving so much. You're already there, so you might as well just, you know, keep plowing through. But, you know, I mean, as it stands, every day is a 10-hour work day anyway because of the doggone commute.
I'll tell you what, let's take tomorrow off and just see how it feels.
Just see what happens with the Joy Monson show, you know. Nicole Thompson might actually prefer that rather than listening to me. Reducing the American work hours to levels in Norway and Denmark would amount to giving U.S. workers an additional 2 months of vacation every year. In 2016, the average U.S. worker spent 1,700 hours on the job, while in Denmark and Norway, they spent 1,400 hours, about an 18% difference. In Sweden and Finland, the number is closer to 1,600 worked out annually. Here's the thing. I like the idea of experimenting. I'm all for companies experimenting with 40-hour work weeks. You know, I've worked in places where some employees work 40 hours a week with 4 days. Some work 5 day shifts. I just don't like government stepping in to mandate that stuff. I like people being able to experiment. There are companies right now. I mean, look at Amazon just said they're going to spend $7,000 per employee to train employees in new jobs. And part of the reason for that is because unemployment's now at about 4%. So, according to some economists, that's basically full employment because there's certain people that aren't going to get a job or you know, they're going to be in between jobs at any given moment. So in this case, I look at it and I think I love the idea, and I like the idea of people having more time. You know, I did an interview one time with Joe Lieberman, the former vice presidential candidate and senator from Connecticut. And Lieberman wrote a book on the Sabbath, the Jewish Sabbath, because he's a serious person of faith. And he was writing about the Sabbath, not for other Jews, but for all people. And he said he wanted the book to apply to people, whether they were religious or not. And actually, I did take the time to read the whole book before the interview. And I thought it was extremely compelling and fascinating. And he explained why the Sabbath is what it is and why they do what they do. And he was saying that it would be a great thing for people to take that time because it's your refresher time. And I think, you know, I just read a story the other day where more and more bosses are emailing their employees on Sunday night. So the stress of work starts to climb up when you start receiving all those notices on Sunday nights. And I think plenty of people can relate to that, where you just feel like you're always on, you're always busy, you're always driving, you're going from one place to the other. And Lieberman's point was you got to take some time away from all that electronics, away from the hustle and bustle, and just not do anything, you know, just relax, take a deep breath, read, be with your family. And I think this is a part of recognizing that's also a part of the human condition. David Bowes in for Joy Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM.